Super Science News.
Welcome to Super Science Me. This is Julia Grillmeier, and this episode is all about cactus, other succulent desert plants, and their often amazing abilities. I grew up near the Danube wetlands in Vienna, and with this soundtrack. Then, last winter, work took me to a place that sounds very different, looks very different, and is the habitat to very different organisms. This is a recording from Phoenix, Arizona. I had never been to a desert landscape before, and I expected the Sonoran Desert to be spectacular, but I didn't expect it to be that spectacular. The Sonoran Desert is very green for a desert. It is very biodiverse, and it is the habitat of a huge variety of cacti and other succulents. It blew my mind for many, many reasons, but the biggest one was definitely its otherworldly vegetation. There are trees with a completely green bark, the Palo Verde trees. Short, large, round cactus, barrel cactus, or many-armed tentacular-growing cactus called organ pipe cactus. And of course, the most famous, the majestic saguaros and the cheerful-looking prickly pear cactus. Every day I rode my bike to Pepego Park, a park that lies in between Phoenix and the city of Tempe. And I looked at the strange geological formations, at roadrunners and at the many succulents. And in the middle of this huge park, you find the Desert Botanical Garden, a very good place to learn more about cactus.
My name is Kim McHugh, and I am the Senior Director for Desert Horticulture and Conservation here at Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix, Arizona.
Dr. Kim McHugh met me at the Desert Botanical Garden, and she showed me the research facilities where cactus and other desert plants are cultivated for research and for conservation purposes.
So my role here is to oversee multiple aspects of the garden's mission work, which includes research into desert plants and their habitats, conservation of those plants and their habitats, also our collections. We have three primary collections. We're looking at part of it right now, which is our living collections, but we also have a herbarium collection and a library collection, all of which supports the mission of our garden. And then also, I have the overall responsibility for horticulture, which is what makes all of this beauty possible day after day after day. It's the people and the expertise that keeps all the plants happy and thriving.
Yeah, so when we walked here, we passed through a lot of groups that had tours already. So it's really both. It's like a museum or something that you can visit, a site, a natural site that you can visit, but it's also a site of research.
Yes, that's exactly right. We are what's considered to be a living museum. So if you think about an art museum, they have their masterpieces on the wall. But here in our botanical garden, our masterpieces are planted in the ground. And it absolutely is a place for the public to come. We are pleased to have over 500,000 visitors every year visit our garden. And actually, in terms of the research, which is a critical part of our mission, it's something that a lot of the visitors don't know that is happening, and we're actually happy anytime we have the opportunity to share that part of what the garden is about. So this is wonderful. I'm so happy to talk to you about it.
As it is a collection, I guess there's a lot of systematical work, like taxonomy. How is it with desert plants? Is there everything already described, or is there a lot to discover still?
Oh, there's always more to discover, absolutely. And we actually, people on our staff have been describing new species. A focus right now for a couple of our researchers is on agaves, and they have been describing over the last several years many new species of agaves, and they will be publishing descriptions of even more in the near future.
Agaves are succulents that grow in large, fleshy, and very pointy leaves, forming large rosettes near the ground. And only the flower, and this flower can be really fantastically beautiful and alien-looking, the flower shoots up and grows in a tall spike.
Some of what's exciting about that work that they are doing is that many of the agaves that they are describing, new to science, are what we call domesticated agaves, and they're associated with pre-Columbian peoples. So peoples that were here in Arizona in the Southwest over 500 years ago, and we know of their presence from archaeological sites, and some of our research staff are collaborating with archaeologists. They go out in the field, they go to these sites, and over the last several years, they started noticing that there are certain kinds of agaves that only are found in these archaeological sites. And they've been putting together the story, if you will, that not only were the peoples that were living here on the land so many centuries ago growing things like beans and corn, things like that, they were actually growing agaves as a crop species. And agaves are really diverse. You can use them for food, for fiber, for drink. They're almost like the buffalo of the desert. You know, you may be familiar with buffalo of the Great Plains of the United States, where the native peoples there, they used every part of the buffalo to sustain them. And so the agaves can play a very similar role.
In the year 300 to 1500, this part of Arizona and Sonora was inhabited by the Huhucam people. Later, Maricopa tribes, the Acumel Otom and Tohono O'odham, developed or settled in this area. While they extensively used cactus and other succulents for sustenance, the famous five C's of Phoenix later economy, so in colonial days at the end of the 19th century up until World War II, these five C's of Phoenix economy were cotton, cattle, citrus, climate, and copper. C, 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 but no cactus. The many information boards in the Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix not only inform about botanical cactus facts, but also how Native Americans used succulents for various materials and fabrics, and how they cooked cactus and other succulents. In the case of the agaves that Kim McHugh mentioned, they were roasted for many, many hours or even days in large pits. As Kim McHugh also said, agaves are very diverse in terms of how humans can use them. But they are also very biodiverse as a plant species. This is also the case for cactus, as she explains.
So another systematic challenge for us are cactus. Okay. So I wanted to share, well, cactus, I think when people think of the desert, cactus are the plant that they think of. And there are about 1,800 different kinds of cactus that occur in the world. I wanted to share that all cactus are native to the New World. So even though you can find cactus today as far away as Australia or in Africa, and certainly cactus are very popular in Europe, they are not native to any of those places. They were introduced there. Cacti are native from Canada, as far north as Canada and all the way down into South America. But taxonomically, they're a very challenging group. And so a lot of the work that we also do here is trying to tease apart, okay, is what we think of as one species of cactus, is it really all the same? Are there actually multiple species within this? And out on the landscape, we can go to different places and there will be areas where it's very clear all of the cactus are very much the same and we can say, yes, these are one species. But then as you go farther away from, say, that central core, the cactus, they look similar, but they're starting to look different. And so we use a lot of molecular techniques. So looking at the DNA and doing sequencing to try and tease apart and determine where those species boundaries really are.
That's really fascinating. We just did an episode on fungi, on mushrooms.
Yes.
And there it's also, the researcher that I talked to also said, actually morphologically, we said this is one species, this is another species, and this is related. And then they did molecular research, mm-hmm. and it turned out that actually from a from an evolutionary point of view, yes. it was completely different,
yeah.
because the morphology doesn't match at all with the evolution line.
Exactly.
And I guess this is also because mushrooms are so fast growing, but cacti actually are so slow growing. So I imagined actually that it would be easier with slow growing species.
Yeah. I think part of it, and I mean, this is my hypothesis, is that cactus, evolutionarily speaking, are a fairly young group. I mean, we're still talking about millions and millions of years. But compared to some of the other flowering plants, they're actually pretty young. And so I think what we're seeing is this snapshot in time where cactus are still evolving and we're sort of catching things in these transition times where they're diverging and evolving. And, you know, the people that come behind us 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now, they're going to see a very different picture, but hopefully what information we leave behind will help them build their clearer picture.
Speaking about the future, how cactus will evolve, of course, also depends how their environment will evolve. And this environment is currently changing a lot faster than it should due to climate change. How is it about climate change, or more generally speaking, the human impact on the environment? Does this affect the cacti?
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. And it's something that we think about all the time. And it's something that our plant physiologist who's on staff, he is studying along with some other collaborators. Because I think a lot of people might have a perception that cactus, because they live in what can be a very harsh environment, very hot temperatures, very little water, things like that, that climate change, the environment getting even warmer, wouldn't be such a problem. But in fact, a lot of cactus, including here in the Sonoran Desert, they're kind of living at the physiological edge right now. And there are literal barriers to their internal metabolism, if you will, of the processes that keep them alive going on. And so what we know is that it's not the temperatures during the day that are the real problem for cactus. It's the nighttime low temperatures. So if at nighttime the temperatures don't go below 90 degrees Fahrenheit, the cactus essentially start to suffocate. It's too hot for their processes internally to work. And they literally start suffocating and dying. And so we have already started to see that here in Phoenix, where we have more nights during the summer where the temperature does not go below 90. And that over time is going to have a really serious impact. And so what choice do the plants have? Well, the individual plants like this giant saguaro that's behind us, it cannot get up and move. Its progeny, its seed, perhaps can. And so there are two options. for plants and animals when the climate that they live in is just getting too warm is that they can move farther north or they can move higher in altitude. But for cactus, like the saguaro, there's another challenge, which is here where we are, we're almost at the northern edge of their range because they're also frost sensitive. And if they go too much farther north or higher in altitude, they're exposed to frost situations, which would also impact them. So it's really concerning to those of us who love these iconic plants. And it's going to be a real challenge. And what the landscape looks like 100 years from now is, it's really hard to say what it's going to be, except that it's going to be different.
Speaking of fast growing and slow growing, so is it for cactus maybe more difficult to adapt because they're so slow growing, or is it because they're still young and in transition evolutionary?
So we generally do say that cactus are slow growing plants, and certainly like a saguaro or the very large cactus that people might be familiar with, they are slow growing. And a saguaro reaches maturity when it starts to flower, maybe when it's 50 years old, maybe even 75 years old. So yes, they are slow growing and slow maturing. There are other cactus that tend to be smaller cactus that grow a lot faster than that and reach maturity faster. So even within the family of cactus, there are these differences. There's a whole spectrum of how fast or how slow they grow, how fast they reach reproductive maturity. And yes, of course, how fast they can reach reproductive maturity affects that evolutionary rate. So yeah, it's different amongst all the species.
That's amazing. To 75 years, it's longer periods than a human, right?
Yes.
It's amazing.
It is. Mm-hmm. And so we do what we call a saguaro inventory every year here in the garden. So in our garden, we have 140 acres, and each year there is a team that goes out and covers basically every inch of those 140 acres, and they document or inventory every single saguaro that we have. And one of the highlights of this process is that every year they will discover baby saguaros, saguaros that we hadn't seen the year before. Their progeny of our adult saguaros. And the thing about it is that when they finally are able to discover them, those baby saguaros are maybe an inch tall. And already that's taken them maybe 3 years to get that large. So it's really fascinating. And something we collect data on this. We track all these saguaros. We have over 1,000 of them in our garden. And we're building this data set that is going to help us and others understand how do saguaros grow, how fast do they grow, how long does it take them to reach certain sizes. So it's great. So that's another thing about research, is that we have researchers in the garden who, yes, they go out into the field, they go out into the wild desert or the natural desert and number of places in the world. But we also use our collections that are right here in the garden for research.
And the big ones, they have such interesting holes in them. Ah. Is this birds?
Yes, it is. It is birds. So the holes in the saguaros are generally made by woodpeckers. But the holes that they create, or the cavities they create, are used by many different species of birds. So the woodpeckers will use them, but other kinds of birds will use them, including owls, and actually some bird species that aren't native to the desert have started using them, like starlings. Some people think that this is really detrimental to the cactus, but unless the cactus is weakened, if it's really old or has got a disease or something, these holes or cavities in them really don't bother them, because what happens is that inside a callus forms. The cactus forms a callus on that tissue that's been damaged, and it creates, we call it a boot. And so actually when we go inside the building, I can show you a cactus boot, and you'll see why. It's just a perfect cavity for birds to build a nest in. Sometimes we call the saguaros the cactus hotel.
Yeah. And what about other symbionts? Do the cacti need other plants or the other animals to grow, actually?
Yes, they do. So again, talking about saguaros, and saguaros are easy to talk about because I think people around the world recognize the saguaro. I remember when I was in Montpellier, France, several years ago for a conference, and I was walking through the streets, and I saw a saguaro cafe, and they had a picture of, you know, the cactus with the arms, and I thought, wow, everybody knows and loves the saguaro. So for saguaros, when they first start out life, their seed is about the size of a poppy seed. So the seed is very small, and they need to land those seeds in order to germinate, and then for the young plant to really grow and survive, they generally need to be under what we call a nurse plant. So a nurse plant could be a tree. We find them growing under Palo Verde trees a lot. Could be under a creosote bush. But those nurse plants are providing shade and protection from animals and things like that. So it's very important for these other kinds of plants to be in the environment for saguaros to successfully reproduce. And then also, when they flower, for pollination, the saguaros are depending on many different kinds of animals, everywhere from bees to bats to birds. And my favorite pollinator of saguaros is the white-winged dove. And the white-winged dove here is migratory. So they come up from Mexico and they time their arrival with the flowering of the saguaros. And they feed on the nectar of the saguaro flowers. And in the process, they're pollinating the flowers. And then they hang around, they're raising their babies, and then they feed on the fruits of the saguaro. And then when that whole season ends, the white-winged doves fly south again. So it's something I look forward to every year. I'm always watching for the first white-winged dove to arrive. And then I'm always sad when I realize, oh, they've all left. But it's that way with all the other cactus as well. They have requirements, they have needs for other animals and or plants, but then these other animals rely on the cactus. They need them for food, sometimes for shelter, like with the saguaro. So yes, it's truly an ecosystem.
Yeah.
And all the parts are relying on all the other parts.
Yeah,
which is the beauty of life to me.
Anna's hummingbird.
Morning, dove. Curve-billed thrasher.
Cactus wren.
And then Kimmy Q takes me on a tour through the research facilities of Desert Botanical Garden. And I learn, for example, how succulent plants can possibly be dried and pressed flat in order to be conserved in an herbarium.
Okay, so this is our newest building. It's the Ahern Desert Conservation Laboratory. So let's go in this first space so you can see the spaces are labeled. This is our herbarium prep space. A herbarium is a collection of pressed, dried plant specimens. And to me, a herbarium is just as valuable and holds just as much information as a library does. It's really incredible. And so there is a process to go from collecting a plant in the field and then having it as a usable specimen in the herbarium. And so where we're standing right now is our herbarium prep room, and this is where our scientists who come back from the field with their collections start that process. So cactus, as you might imagine, are a little bit difficult to press flat. And so you don't see a lot of herbaria with really, really good cactus herbarium specimens because they are difficult to prepare. Part of it requires slicing the cactus. So basically slicing it in half so you've got a flat edge, but then also scooping out, like literally we have scoops. We scoop out all of the internal tissue. Then we have to dry it. And sometimes to dry it, we submerge them in a bucket of alcohol that actually will help dry them out. Then we put them in the press, and then we can put them in a dryer. So we have plant dryers here, which is just a cabinet that seals, that has a heat source and a fan. So it circulates warm air to dry the specimens. And once that is complete, then we take them into another building. First, we put them in a freezer, and the freezing process will kill any insects or larvae that might be on the specimen, because that is the worst enemy of a herbarium collection. Because if you have bugs in your herbarium collection, they'll eat your collection. So we're very, very careful in making sure all of our specimens are clean.
That was absolutely one thing that I was wondering about, how to get succulents into a herbarium. Yes.
And so agaves, oh my goodness, agaves are really interesting. So they have these long succulent leaves, and they will often have very prickly edges, mm-hmm. and then a pointy spine at the end. And so what we do, it's, oh my goodness, and it can literally be bloody work, is we have to strip the top layer of that leaf from the rest of it. And that's what gets pressed and preserved. It's tough. It's really tough. And because these desert plants have all of these defenses of spines and prickles and sharp points, you have to be really dedicated to it.
Working in a garden full of plants that have all these defense systems is risky. At the end of our interview, Kim McHugh draws a large spine out of the sole of her shoe.
So I was feeling, I thought like it was a stone in my shoe. No.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
It's a cactus spine that's gone all the way through the leather of the shoe. Yeah, so these are the fruits. So this is the spent flower, and then this is now the fruit that's developing. Yeah. You have to move carefully amongst the cactus.
Another part of the plants that get preserved here are the seeds.
This whole half of the building is about seed banking. And so the space that we're in right now is where we do seed cleaning. So seed collections come in and they get put on this shelf. So you can see here's a bag full of fruits, another container full of fruits, and so on. And then we have many volunteers, very dedicated, wonderful volunteers who will come in. This is where they sit. They've got all their tools that they need, and they will clean by hand all of these seeds. And then they get packaged and they come into this space. Which is the seed preservation lab, which is where we have our seed freezer. So this is where ultimately we'll put the seeds for long-term storage. And they're all in these sealed foil packages. Mm-hmm. This is a minus 20 degree freezer. Yeah. And so seeds, most of the seeds that we have here are what are called orthodox seeds. So they will do well in this kind of cold storage. Some of them will last for decades. Some of them might last a century. Mm-hmm. So it makes managing the collection a little bit challenging, but also it's really cool because periodically we will pull samples out and do germination tests to see, this seed lot is 5 years old. how many of the seeds will germinate. Oh, this one is 20 years old. How many of the seeds are still viable?
So it's not only like for genetic analysis purposes, but they really germinate after being frozen.
Yes, exactly. And so when we do those germination trials, we have a germination chamber, and this allows us to control the light period. So how many hours the light's on, how many hours the light is off, and then also the temperature and the humidity. So you can see we have a lot of different trials going on right now. I'll pull one of these out. So this is, these are cactus seeds of, it's called a hedgehog cactus. And so these are teeny tiny baby cactus that have started to germinate in there. And then we also, we document all our seeds. We have, we call it the seed photography lab, which is this setup here. And it's really a mini photography studio. And it's pretty sophisticated. I think by looking at it, you can kind of tell that. We've got a 35 millimeter camera. It's hooked up to the computer. And where we put the seeds is on this little stage back here. We have flash here, so the lighting, and it's actually amazingly difficult to work to get the light just right to photograph a seed. Here is an example of the kind of images that we collect. So this is a species that's native to Arizona. It's called the Arizona oringo. It's a herbaceous species. It's really beautiful, and its seeds are beautiful too. And you can see the resolution that we get with this photography setup. And I mean, it's just incredible. And what you're seeing here is both sides of the seed. Some people think we cut the seed in half. No, this is essentially the front, and this is the back. And the thing about this, if you look at it, you think about a seed is 3D, right? And if you take a photo and you're focused on a 3D object, part of that object is going to be in focus, and then other part of it is not going to be in focus. So the way that we get all of the seed to be in focus is with this setup. You can see that the camera is on a little sliding platform here, and this is the part that controls it. This is a little computer piece that controls it. And so when everything is set up, basically the person running this says go, and the camera will take a photo, and then the computer will move the camera just a tiny bit, takes another photo, moves the camera, takes another photo. And so what's happening is that every plane of that 3D seed is getting a photo that is in focus. And then we have software that takes all those images and basically smashes them together so that every part of the seed is in focus. And I mean, they're beautiful, as you can see in that image. But it's also important because sometimes the characteristics of the seed are have the diagnostic characteristics that allows us to determine one species from another. Our big focus is to photograph all of the cactus seeds, because that will help us in determining one species of cactus from another. And this one, this is saguaro seeds. So this is the the high resolution images, and then here's the actual seeds. So you can see.
It's almost microscopic, the image, actually.
Yes.
I mean, but I can't even imagine the distances must be so small when it's about focus or non-focus, like the depth of a seed that is only
Not even a millimeter. Tiny. Yeah. Right, exactly, exactly. So, yeah, we love this. And the person, his name is Steve Blackwell, who runs the seed photography lab, he has spent a lot of time perfecting the process. And then there's one other space in this building, which is our soil ecology lab. So our researcher here, his name is Dr. Joe McCullough, and he is an extraordinary scientist. He's been working in desert ecology for many decades, and it's incredible by looking at soil and soil profiles, and then linking it up with what he sees and what he knows about plants, the stories he can tell about the landscape and how it developed and how it affects the vegetation, and also how the vegetation affects the landscape. So one of the things that he has found is that there are some kinds of plants that in a desert setting where there's a lot of dust blowing around, these plants will actually trap this dust, and as it accumulates, basically it's building up a layer of soil, which then plants depend on. Mm-hmm. So again, it's this, plants in a way are helping to create their own place to live.
When you talk to researchers who focus on plants,
yeah,
you completely lose this idea of plants as being this very passive, just a seed drops somewhere and then they grow.
Oh.
Because they're so, as you said, they're so creating their own space and are actually so active species.
Absolutely.
And when, yes, I talked to the director of the Botanical Garden in Vienna, mm-hmm, he said that such stories, as, yes, you just mentioned, they really help to get rid of plant blindness.
Yes.
I guess these stories are also like good medicine against plant blindness.
Yes, well, we hope so. We hope so. And I mean, you will find, I think you probably have already found, that people that work with plants, people that work in botanical gardens, are really passionate about what we do, and we love our plants. And it's because they are far from passive. They are incredible living organisms that are endlessly fascinating to study.
And this love for plants, of course, does not only show in the research, but also in conservation projects. When Kim McHugh and I walk by some small cute cacti that grow in clusters of little knobs covered over and over with pointy spines, she tells me the rather incredible story of how they came here as temporary residents.
Actually, since we're walking through here, so, I mean, it's beautifully landscaped back here. So even though this is back of house, when we created this, we wanted it to be a lovely space for the people who work here. I want to stop and point this plant out. So you see, it's called the Arizona hedgehog cactus. And that particular cactus, it is an endangered species, and it is endemic to the state of Arizona. So it occurs here and nowhere else in the world, at least that we know of. And this particular plant that we're looking at, and there are several others that are planted back here, are part of a rescue operation that the garden is involved in. The place that these grow naturally is not too far from here. It's just to the east of Phoenix. A lot of them grow on these rocky cliff sides. And there was a project happening where there was a bridge that it was determined that this bridge was too far gone to repair, and they were going to have to tear it down and build a new bridge. And in the process, it was going to impact habitat of these cactus. There were a lot of cactus that would be lost. And so the garden was able to partner with the Arizona Department of Transportation and also our U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to go out ahead of the construction project. And our team literally were rappelling down the sides of the cliffs to extract these cactus from the cliffside. And we brought them here and we're caring for them. And for many of these larger ones, so this is one cactus that has many stems,
okay,
is that the best thing for them is to have their roots in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so our conservation collections manager, he said, okay, so he planted them in various parts here. We're going to have them here for 2 years, allowing them to recover from having been taken from their home. They have flowered in the first year that we had them here. We collected seeds. And when that bridge project is completed, then we have the opportunity to take these back, put them back into the wild, and also we have the seed that they've produced, and we're going to be growing baby cactus to also supplement the population. So that's another kind of thing that we do here. So I just realized recording may be a little more challenging because now the fans have turned
we
off.
We enter a greenhouse.
So here we call this Bay 3 of one of our greenhouses, and you can see it's entirely cactus. And these are cactus that we keep in a greenhouse because they are from environments, their native environments are different than where we are here in Phoenix. And these particular cactus, they're adapted to heat. In the summertime, we can let this particular greenhouse bay get pretty hot, into the 90s. I mean, they could even tolerate it if we let it get over 100 degrees, but we don't. But what they can't tolerate is cold. And here in Phoenix, in the winter, it can go down to 40 degrees at night. Occasionally, we get frost. So for those reasons, we have to keep these cactus here in a greenhouse.
There are so many different looking cactus.
You can see the just incredible diversity of forms of cactus. And I mean, look at this. This, does that even look like a living thing? It looks like a stick. And then you have these crazy things that look kind of like snakes. And then you have columnar cactus, yes, that are in the back there. Let me show you some of these. These cactus are called Areocarpus, and you can see they're kind of in these stacked flat layers. And what happens with these, and it happens with some other cactus species as well, is that in the wild, if conditions get really, really dry, I mean like really dry, they will start to contract, and they'll actually contract and be flat with the ground or go underground.
Wow.
And so if you're out looking for cactus species, mm-hmm, like this, you have to realize that even if you don't see them at a particular time that you're there, it may not mean that they're not there. Mm-hmm. It may just mean they're hiding out underground. You know, and I think that's another thing that surprises people, is because we think of plants that, yes, the seed goes in the ground, but then the plant, mm-hmm, is above ground. But the idea that plants would actually, mm-hmm, say, nope, I'm going under, but they do.
Yes.
So these are all South American cactus that we're looking at here. They're from a genus called Copiapoa.
Some have fluffy white crowns, or rather little nests on top.
So what is the white crust?
So it's interesting, isn't it? And it's called a cephalum, mm-hmm, and it's this fluffiness, yes, that develops at the crown of these plants. And what role does it play? We're not really sure,
yeah,
but it's completely normal, absolutely normal. And it actually makes them look kind of interesting because they get that fuzzy, it almost looks like cotton or something, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah. And then you can also see that there's a difference in the spines. That's another way that we can identify one cactus from another, one cactus species from another, is the form of the spines. And so if you look closely, you'll see that the spines are coming out of a central place, and we call those areoles. And you can see this particular species, the spines and where they're coming out of is very different from this species,
yeah,
right next to it. The color of the spines is different, the length of the spines is different, what that areole looks like is different. So that is another diagnostic tool that we use.
Mm-hmm. This one looked like they have a hat on.
Yes.
Wow.
And some people ask me, oh, it looks so soft. Can, mm-hmm, I touch it? And I say, yeah, I know it looks soft, but you don't. Sometimes the soft ones are the worst ones, and they get in your skin, and they're hard to get out. There are a few cactus that, yeah, it's okay to touch. But generally my advice is don't do it unless,
yeah,
you've got gloves on. Yeah, so these.
Then there are some
here
that look like floppy long tubes.
Draping over their pots. These are a species that in the wild, they mainly get their water from fog. It doesn't rain,
yeah,
but they get they get their moisture from fog. So cactus are amazingly adapted. I mean, and you find cactus, in places like here in Phoenix in the Sonoran Desert and Lowland Desert, but you also find them on coastal areas. You find them in higher altitudes. They're really an amazing group of plants. And I want to also be sure to share before we wrap up that cactus, they are amazing. They're iconic desert plants. They're very diverse, but they're also highly threatened. And in 2015, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature completed what's called the Global Cactus Assessment, in which experts evaluated every species of known cactus for its conservation status. And at the end of that process, it was actually really shocking to everyone involved when all that data was put together that fully a third of all of the species are threatened with extinction. And that puts the cactus family as one of the most threatened groups of organisms on the planet. They're right there in the same company as corals and amphibians, and then also conifers and cycads. And another striking thing from the study, from the Global Cactus Assessment, is that while there are many factors that threaten cactus, the primary threat is illegal poaching from the wild. So it's a serious, big problem.
Therefore, as Kim McHugh explains, it is important to buy cactus only from sources that are reliable.
It's great to have cactus. I have cactus in my home garden, but the most important thing is that when you are acquiring cactus, make sure you're getting it from a reputable source that you know where those cactus came from. Ideally, they've been propagated by the nursery or whoever it is, not directly taken from the wild.
And then we make two last stops on our tour through the Desert Botanical Garden research buildings, the molecular lab and the already mentioned herbarium.
So I was talking about how we do a lot of genetic work. So I'll just walk you through the molecular lab that we have. We're really fortunate as a botanical garden to have facilities like this. So you saw our new building, which is really great. And then we also have this, we have space for 8 researchers to be working. And so that can include both our own staff and then students and visiting scientists. And then this is the back way. This is the secret back way to the herbarium. So here's the freezer room. I was talking about how specimens come in and then we freeze them to kill anything that's on the specimens. And then eventually,
this is to have the herbarium.
They come here, yes. And we have, there's a mounter working. So the people who mount the specimens are primarily volunteers. And they're fantastic. Hello.
Hi.
So, hi, I'm giving a little tour and interview for Julia, who is from Austria.
Hi, Julia.
And she's recording for a broadcast, radio broadcast. Anyway, so we're wrapping up, and I wanted to make sure to just come through the herbarium. So it's cool that you're mounting.
So what I'm doing is mounting a specimen that was collected. This is all the information, the data that was collected, when they were out there. Gives a location, what it is, what the surroundings are, and the actual collector's home. And then this is a little packet. Some of these little berries fell off. So if I have debris, twigs, broken off parts that I know are from this, I don't want to sweep them up off the table. But anyway, that goes on here. This goes on here. And then eventually there'll be a little tiny barcode right here. So that they can scan it and identify it. And the specimen you place on here in such a way that you can get the front of the leaf, the back of the leaf, different stem parts, seeds or flowers. Or we try not to trim, but if you need to, you can, I suppose.
I mean, it's a real art form, and it's I mean, I think the art starts with the person who collects it and puts it in the press, and then the laying out of the specimen on the sheet.
This is what we start with. The person who collects them actually puts them in this paper.
Mm-hmm.
So what they collect, you know, is what we get, and they try to make it the right size for us. Sometimes they have to bend a little bit. Sometimes we get a flower, sometimes we don't. Sometimes there just aren't flowers. Sometimes they dry kind of creepy looking, but mm-hmm. you can arrange them in such a way that they kind of always have a little flair to them.
And all of our specimens, in addition to being mounted, as you're seeing, they will also get photographed, and then they are uploaded to a database that anyone can access online. It's called SignNet. SeinEt. If you Google SignNet, you'll get to it, and you can search not just our herbarium collection, but multiple herbarium collections with plants from the Southwest. Wow, yeah.
SignNet, the digital collection that Kim McHugh just referred to, as well as more information and links to the Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix, are listed in the show notes to this podcast. Also check SuperScienceMe on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook to see some pictures of all these cacti, agaves, palo verde trees, and ironwood trees, and other desert plants and animals.
If you look, so here's this ironwood tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a cactus growing underneath it and through its branches, and you can see the cactus, how high it's gotten into the tree.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
They're also like kind of symbionts, I guess, or they like...
Yeah,
to grow
right,
near
because
each other.
There are certain cactus that are like this. They like to grow up, but they mm-hmm. need something basically to hang on to.
Oh, okay.
To mm-hmm. be able to mm-hmm. get that high.
Wow, yes.
Yeah, and this bloomed recently. Mm-hmm. You can see here's the flower. So,
oh,
you can
wow.
see how
that's huge.
Yeah, and they're just spectacular when they're mm-hmm. when they open.
So do they bloom normally once a year, or is it?
You know, this one, it's funny. Oh, here's some that are.
Oh wow, they're really
they're also
beautiful.
Spent, but they're. Oh, and there's more
huge.
Buds
yes.
over here.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can wow. sort of imagine what they're like.
Yes.
I feel like this one will flower at different times of the year. Mm-hmm. I mean, this right now, it seems to be super happy. Like maybe it's because. The weather changed and it finally got cooler.
Yeah.
But there are cactus in the garden, some barrel cactus, that in the absolute dead of summer, when it's the hottest, they bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I walk past them and it makes me smile because I just think, you go cactus, like here we all are going like, oh, it's so hot. And you are saying, life is wonderful, look at me.
Thanks to Desert Botanical Garden, and of course especially to Dr. Kim McHugh for taking me on this tour, which definitely helped fight my plant blindness.